This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
Onto our round table, we are talking the universal basic income guarantee. Is this the best tool to reduce poverty, hunger, and destitution? To help us in that conversation, we are on the line with Chair of the Chain Social Justice Faculty of Law, Stellenbosch University, and founder of Tuma Foundation, Professor Thulima Donsela, and also Neil Coleman, the founder of Institute for Economic Justice. We'll try and understand what the Universal Basic Income Guarantee is and what it serves to do, as we know that we are now faced with the reality for many people that the COVID-19 grant is coming to an end in just a couple of days. Neil Coleman, good evening and welcome to Power Perspective.
Good evening, Quena, to Prof. Tuli and to your listeners.
Good evening, Prof. Good evening to you too. Prof. Matonzela, good evening. Okay, we'll see if we can get Professor Thulima Donsela on a better line there. But Neil, while we're doing that, looking at the Universal Basic Income Guarantee, and maybe to simplify it, what are we talking about?
What we're talking about, Quena, is that, you know, historically a lot of people assume that the way that we people earn their living or their income is through regular forms of work and through employment, or through working the land and those sorts of activities. The reality now in the international situation that we face, particularly post-COVID, is that guaranteed forms of work and livelihoods have been severely disrupted. So internationally around the world, people are looking at the situation and saying that, you know, societies cannot be sustainable in a situation where so many people are living in precarious circumstances, and therefore that as part of the social contract that societies, governments guarantee citizens a basic income, a regular basic income, which provides a floor, which means that they get an income regularly every month, and then in addition they earn whatever income they can through other forms of activity, whether it's employment, as I said, on the land or you know, through businesses, etc. And in South Africa, you know, we face an extreme situation where we have amongst the highest levels of unemployment and inequality in the world, and therefore the question of a universal basic income has been put on the agenda very sharply in recent months, although this debate goes back to the late 1990s, when it was placed as a proposal in the Presidential Job Summit. And then, as you know, the a special commission was set up, chaired by Professor Vivian Taylor, which recommended the adoption of a universal basic income grant. And so now, in the post-COVID situation, this is something that government is seriously investigating, and civil society is saying must be done, because the crisis measures that we've seen that have been put in place, in particular the COVID grant, the 350 rand grant, have saved, you know, over 6 million people from destitution, and therefore, you know, people shouldn't be left to the mercy of this economic depression. And should be provided with a level of basic income, which would give effect to the constitutional requirement that there be social security for everybody in the country.
Mm. Let's welcome again on the line, Professor Thulima Donsela. Good evening and welcome to Power Perspective, Prof.
Good evening. Thank you for the privilege to be part of this.
Thank you very much for coming through to talk to us. Not sure how much of my conversation with Neil you caught there, but just to bring you into the conversation, speaking of the Universal Basic Income Guarantee, on face value, from your perspective, Prof. Madonsela, is it Something that the best tool, to put it simply, that South Africa can use in this instance to deal with issues of poverty, hunger, and destitution that many South Africans are facing on a daily basis?
Absolutely. We're not there yet in terms of giving everyone a basic income grant. However, the distress grant makes sure that those among us who are left behind when it comes to income don't go extremely hungry. There already is hunger, and 350,000 will not stop hunger totally, but it will make a huge difference, as you have seen with some of the surveys that have been conducted by some of your colleagues, some journalists. It's clear that it's making a huge, huge difference.
So, Neil, who then will be targeted with this universal basic income? And how different is it then, one can say, from the normal grants that South Africans are getting?
Yes. I think, you know, we need to acknowledge the fact that children in our society are getting grants, and old age and old age pensioners are getting grants, but those aged 18 to 59 fall through the cracks. And if we identify the fact that over 11 million people are unemployed in our society, and many more are very precariously employed, as well as a lot of caregivers who are not remunerated for their work, then it means of those in the 18 to 59 age group, many, many millions of South Africans are living in poverty. And so the idea with a universal basic income guarantee, you know, if we look at the words, you know, universal and income and guarantee, the idea is that it goes to everybody, you know, and that it's guaranteed as a right. It's not something that can be taken away. The question that people immediately ask is, but, you know, are you going to give this to wealthy people, or people who are comfortably off? And so basically the idea is, the reason you give it universally is that means testing, where you identify people based on their employment status or their level of income, is often used by bureaucrats, whether intentionally or unintentionally, to deny people their rights. And we've seen that SASSA has battled, you know, with the COVID grant. You know, we may have had over 9 million people applying for the grant, but only about 6 million people actually get the grant approved. And part of the reason for that is that people have great difficulty in proving that they're unemployed or that they have very little income. So the reason to make it universal is it makes it much more efficient. It's just allocated to everybody. And then the wealthy and the middle classes pay it off via forms of taxation, either whether it's income tax or something like a social security tax, in which you give back to the state more than you are receiving, and therefore cross-subsidize the poor in society. So it's really just a mechanism to ensure that it's done most efficiently and fairly, but that at the same time there is cross-subsidization by the wealthy for the poorer members of society.
Prof, just picking up on Neil's point, are we then not creating too much dependency on the state for South Africans, granted that there's a lot of South Africans that are actually in need of these grants?
Thank you. Firstly, just good evening to Neil, and thank you, Neil, and your colleagues for the work you're doing. Now, by giving a universal income grant, you are not creating dependency. If anything, somebody tweeted today that it's a good thing to teach people how to fish, but feeding them before they can go fishing just makes perfect sense, because nobody's going to go fishing, or nobody's going to go to learn how to fish when they're hungry. When our children are given money, whether it is some kind of stipend whilst they're looking for jobs, or a stipend whilst they are starting new businesses, we don't see it as creating dependency. But when we say, let's use the money that is generating, that's generated from all of us collectively, to even the playing field by giving some basic income grant to those who have nothing, we start talking about dependency. That's just being dishonest.
Mm. But then, with that said, if you look at the ages, Neil, if I got you well, that are being targeted, it's ages of 18 to 59 that are not targeted within the current grants that government is giving. And one would argue then again, and I'd like the prof also to respond, I would argue that those are the ages where under a normal circumstances or in a normal society, and I'm using that deliberately, a person between those ages will be able to earn some sort of income for themselves.
Yes, exactly. And you know, if you look at my introductory comments, when you ask me, you know, why this has been put on the agenda, not in, only in South Africa, but internationally, is that societies are no longer normal. You know, the situation that societies are deeply have a deep crisis, an economic and social crisis, and our societies have become very skewed. For example, very financialized. So a lot of the resources of society are going into the financial sector rather than into a creation of productive employment. So this is much more the case in South Africa, where we have over 11 million people unemployed. So the idea that we can use normal mechanisms in a completely abnormal situation simply won't work. I was in a very interesting webinar this last week, convened by the Catholic Office in Cape Town, in which someone who had been involved in implementing a trial in Namibia spoke about how the introduction of a basic income to a local community had made a huge difference in spurring on economic activity, because suddenly a very poor community had income to spend, and then people were able to build bakeries and other small businesses, which were then supported by the community. And this actually supports the international experience, which has shown that, you know, income transfers have a range of benefits, whether in Brazil, when Namibia, Kenya, a number of other countries where these experiments have been done. Far from creating dependency, they actually increase job seeking. You know, if you look at Stats SA statistics about the number of unemployed, they talk about the discouraged unemployed and the unemployed who are actively looking for work. Many of the discouraged unemployed are not looking for work, in part because they cannot afford to seek work. So what you've seen in Brazil is that you know, these grants have actually increased job seeking. They've increased school attendance. They've supported nutrition and health, stimulated local economies, and assisted agriculture and informal businesses. So it should be seen as an investment in communities, not as something which makes people passive. In fact, the most passive and dependence creating thing, which puts people into depression, actually, is unemployment and having to rely on others to support them in their community. The difference here is that society is supporting them and encouraging them to become actively involved in both economic and social activities.
We are in conversation with Neil Coleman, the founder of the Institute for Economic Justice, and also Professor Thuli Madonsela, Chair of Social Justice Faculty of Law, Stellenbosch University, and founder of Tuma Foundation. We are talking about the Universal Basic Income Guarantee. Is it the best tool to reduce poverty, hunger, and destitution? You want to join in on the conversation? It's 0861-987-000. Otherwise, you can tweet at PowerFM987 or tweet me directly at Marara Mwabelo. Prof, now, what one would then ask that in a country that has to go and ask for money, you know, in order just to keep afloat during a crisis, where does the money come from? Where will the money to give this basic income guarantee, where will it come from?
Thank you. That's a very important question. Where does the money come from? Number one, you could still borrow it. The World Bank country director for South Africa was with us at Women Ready to Lead today at 2, and she said the problem is not debt. The problem is debt for what? If you're going to borrow money, are you borrowing money to generate more money? And Niels has just given us examples of how when people do get this money, they become less depressed, more motivated to seek jobs, to consider starting their own businesses, etc. So that's one way we could borrow it. But secondly, there's a lot of set in the system. If you look at how much money has been wasted in Medupi, SOEs, SASA, people were paying for security for their own children, for their own friends. If you just claw back that money and you no longer are paying for those things, that means those budget items no longer exist and that money can be rechanneled. A whole lot of wasteful expenditure that the Auditor General spoke about. If we can anticipate that we will push back on that front, we can then anticipate that that money that would have gone into that waste is going to go into this 3,500 rand, possibly increased to about 5,000 at the very least.
So, Neil, will this then not hinder economic growth?
No, in fact, on the contrary, Quena, you know, we've commissioned some modelling activity by an internationally renowned economist who's done a lot of work on South Africa, and he's modelled this the implementation of a grant at various levels, and what he's found is that the likely result is actually going to be an increase in economic growth because of what I explained, which is a stimulus effect of circulating money in local economies, particularly poor communities. People can't in a position to save to keep the earnings that they have. They spend it in those local communities,
so they will be contributing to the economy.
Exactly. It generates further economic activity. And actually, this modeler, this economist who modeled these outcomes, actually also found that the deficit, the budget deficit, and the debt to GDP ratio, the level of debt when compared to the size of our economy, would actually go down, even though, you know, we would be talking about spending a couple of hundred billion rand on the poorest in our society. So that's the issue, is that it should be seen as an investment and as a stimulus to economic activity, which is very different from the types of conventional economic policy prescriptions which our own national treasury is following. And as Prof. Modenseller has said, you know, this statement from the World Bank person is that if you invest in the right thing, it has certain what economists call multipliers. It has certain downstream benefits in terms of creating jobs, economic activity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So universal basic income should not be seen as something that is a solution, is a silver bullet to everything. It must be combined with other policies which ensure there's investment in the right areas, job creation, diversification of our industries and of our economy. But it certainly can make a major contribution in that direction.
With that said, Neil, I mean, looking at the fact that now the COVID-19 grant will be coming to an end, you know, a possible extension then does it not then in one part solve that problem?
It's a very much a stopgap solution. Mm-hmm. Firstly, the 350 rand is very, very little. It's too little. It's below the food poverty line. So the organizations that have been doing research on the cost of food for a household have shown that this is way beyond what is required. And people who are getting the grants, while they are very grateful for the little that they're getting in this crisis, have identified the fact that they are running out of money to buy food sort of by the middle of the month. So it needs to be improved, but also it needs to be a guarantee. As I indicated, you know, a lot of people who've applied haven't actually received the grant. Sometimes they get it, sometimes they don't get it. You know, you have to have zero income. So if you've got any money in your account, then you will be refused the grant. So it's these sorts of arbitrary decisions that are made that make people extremely vulnerable and dependent. They need something which is a regular, guaranteed source of income. So yes, the COVID grant is a very important step towards the implementation of the universal basic income. And that's why we're saying government has said that they're investigating this. The ANC has got a committee that's investigating this. So let us extend it for as long as is needed, probably for the next year, while the process of putting a universal basic income into place is finalized.
Prof, I mean, guaranteed, and from what you and Neil are saying, is that universal basic grant will, without a doubt, help families to afford expenses, you know, but would it not then create this financial inequality across society? You know, as we know in South Africa, that's, you know, it will then say that those who are poorer, who are poor will remain poor, and those who are working in good positions will then become a little bit richer in this case.
Well, it is not going to end inequality. It will end destitution and desperation. And a lot of studies, as Neil has said, show that when people are too desperate, they cease to hunger for improvement. When you're just too hungry for food, you cease to be hungry to improve the quality of your life, the quality of your economic life. And therefore, both the COVID-19 grant create an environment that enables people to rescue their humanity and start improving their own lives in other ways. It doesn't end inequality. It just protects people from the harshness of poverty and inequality. Just lastly, we do know that we don't have the money. It's just going to be about what do we shift. And I've written about this in the Financial Mail, is that we have to make a decision. Either way, we're going to pay. If we don't pay this, for example, if we don't extend the COVID-19 distress grant, we're going to pay. We're going to pay through anger, through destitution, through people rising up and going with whatever political entrepreneur asks them to do against us. So we will pay. So we have to choose whether we want to pay this way, where we can control the way we pay, or we want to pay in a sporadic way where a pseudo-revolution is started by political entrepreneurs who have other problems. Some of them, for example, are in conflict with the law, but they will make people rise as if they care about people, but they don't care. They're the very same people who may have stolen from the people.
Mm. So, Prof, again, staying with that point then, does this then speak to... I mean, at the risk of bringing politics into this, that we then have to have a government that has the political will, not only the financial means, but the political will to get something like this to be fast-tracked. Neil spoke about the fact that this was discussed way back in 1998 at the Jobs Summit, and only now we are starting to seriously talk about it, and we had the 350 grants coming in because of a crisis.
Absolutely. We need a political will, but we also need lateral thinking and systems thinking. Our government has been told, spend carefully. If you don't spend properly, you're going to have a runaway economy, and your investors are going to run away. But what our government is not told is that investors are going to run away anyway when there's crime, when there's uncertainty, when there's anger. Already America has given a very unfavorable advice on tourism. We might have more governments giving that kind of advice. We just can't afford at this stage to withdraw this grant from our people. But Neil said something extremely important, Gwena, is that as we give people this temporary grant, or even as we consider a universal grant, let's also consider a universal income security plan. How do we plan to make sure that everyone has a way of making a living, even if it's just for food security, even if it's not getting a job, but being able to generate some food for themselves and some income for themselves?
So Neil, which brings me to the point of how much should it be? And how do we arrive at that? You look at the food poverty line. You are those things that are being considered to come to to how much should this UBIC be?
So, you know, obviously the preference is to have a decent basic income on which people can live a decent life. The reality is that in the short term, we're going to battle to implement a level guarantees that that decent life, but at least it should be a minimum level which is not below the poverty line. There are three poverty lines which South Africa uses: the food poverty line, the lower bound poverty line, and the upper bound poverty line, which are in a range of
around
between 600 rand and 1200 rand. It should be at the very least in that range. And the Institute for Economic Justice has issued a policy brief in which we calculate these various amounts, how much it would cost, and how it could be financed. And we can tweet it out so that your listeners can have a look at the brief and how we do those calculations. But the point really is that I think your point was very important in the props, that it's about political will and it's about structuring it in a smart way, that it's progressive, that those who earn the least, who need it the most, get the most, and those who need it the least actually contribute the most. So there's a level of progressivity in the system, both in the way in which it's structured, in terms of who gets it, as well as how it's financed. And there are, you know, a range of financing proposals which are out there. Internationally now, Quena, the mood is changing. You've seen Joe Biden, the President of the United States, saying that corporations must pay their fair share. There must be a minimum international rate of tax and these sorts of things. So governments which had been, historically saying there must be, lower and lower and lower rates of tax are now accepting that in order to deal with this crisis, that wealthy corporations and wealthy individuals must pay. And so that is going to be the direction that countries are taking. And therefore, South Africa has to be one of the countries that leads the way in that regard, given the extreme needs in our society.
Is it a question of making them pay, asking them nicely, or texting them when you say making them pay?
No, it's not. It's not asking nicely. It's not asking for voluntary contributions. You know, governments have, we have rules that we all have to abide by. You know, when income tax is levied on us, or small businesses are asked to pay tax, that business has to pay tax. But it's the large corporations who are not paying their fair share of tax, that are putting their money in tax havens, et cetera, et cetera. So there must be compliance. There must be equality before the law. And the most wealthy and the most powerful must not refuse to pay their fair share. So no one's asking for punitive action. We're just asking that everybody pays their fair share. And I think that's what government needs to ensure.
Just a quick one, Prof, from your side then. I mean, we speak about government, but is there a role for corporate South Africa to play in this regard, or should it be something that is purely in the hands of government?
Both have a role. If corporate South Africa were to decide, for example, that those who are super rich are prepared to give, let's say, 5% income for this particular distress period. And then the rest of us who have continued to have jobs during this distress period, give 1% of our salary for the rest of the year. We could cover this money if government can't. So there are many options. Just the last thing, Gwena, when your child is between jobs, you give them an allowance. It has never made them late.
Mm.
All rich people, all middle-class people do that with their children, with their relatives. We share income, but it doesn't make people lazy. And it's so weird that when it comes to the underprivileged in society.
But Prof, you know, on a lighter note, we give it with a heavy heart. It's like, hey, Mutamudimi, you're sitting at home doing nothing, and now I have to maintain your lifestyle.
We do, but we still do it. And they still, based on that, with that heavy heart, with encouragement, they proceed and they do something with their lives. All I'm trying to say is the Oppenheimer children have never gone hungry and they never then became lazy.
Prof Thuli Madonsela and Neil Coleman, we're going to have to leave it there. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but thank you very much for coming through this evening to talk to us. We appreciate it.
Many thanks.
Thank you. Thank you,
Gwena. That's Professor Thuli Madonsela and Neil Coleman, who's the founder of the Institute for Economic Justice.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.